Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone. It's another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast, and I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, with four incredible guests to talk about a very timely topic. We are just a week and a half or so away from Pioneer Day, July 24th. Huge celebration in Utah. I remember in California when I grew up and things like that, it certainly was a big deal. We're wondering if it has remained at the fever pitch that it once was, how Mormon pioneer heritage is playing in people's lives and thoughts and consciousness today. We have the phenomenon of the handcart treks, where stakes are taking their youth out and giving them an adventure to try to give them a taste of what this is. We know that there's some criticisms of that, as well as many people defend it. So we're just going to kind of take this moment to talk about pioneers and all the ways that they affect Mormon consciousness and thought and discourse for good as well as for ill. And when I think of good on this, I've got to introduce our first guest, who's such a favorite here. And Joanna, I looked it up, and you haven't been on since April. Unforgivable.
I've missed you.
We have missed you. But thank you for coming on. But I just... you're just such a, you just come to my mind quite quickly because your book, Book of Mormon Girl, has you in a pioneer bonnet on the cover. And
yeah.
And when I first met you, I think it was the first time we actually met in person. It was at the Salt Lake Mormon Stories Conference a year ago, June. And you had your pink bonnet there. I even got photographed with it on, and I got a picture of you and me together with you wearing it. So tell us about that bonnet and your background.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the bonnet. Hi, everybody. My name is Joanna Brooks. I'm delighted to be here with people I admire and love. And I'm the author of the Book of Mormon Girl, which I'm excited to say is going to be re-released in a new and expanded edition with some new chapters on August 7th by the Free Press, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. And you're going to be able to get it at Barnes & Noble and places like that, as well as, drumroll, Deseret Book.
So, all right.
Yes. Cool. So happy to be here.
Super. We do send me a link so I can post it so people can pre-order that and get known on that. So we love having you back. Thanks so much. And we'll talk a little bit more about your pioneer.
My pioneer hang-ups.
Well, your hang-ups, but to me, really, what I'm fascinated by, and I know you'll talk about it, is the connection that sort of served for you during this time when you were away from
during a
Mormonism.
Pivotal time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So that's what we'll get to. So another podcast favorite who's back, I think, probably fourth or fifth time, is Gina Colvin from New Zealand.
Yo,
welcome.
Kia ora.
What?
Kia ora.
Okay. All right.
It's hello in Maori.
Awesome. Would you mind telling us a little bit more about you, or just remind people a little bit about your background?
Sure. I live in Christchurch, New Zealand, the quakey city. We have calculated we have had over 10,000 quakes in the last 18 months. So
Crazy. That's
been pretty exciting. I'm a lecturer at the University of Canterbury in cultural studies and critical curriculum and treaty education. I'm also the gospel doctrine teacher in my ward and have been recently called to be the stake assistant historian.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
I know. Charged with the responsibility of creating a piece of work on the history of the church in Christchurch that is going to be faith promoting.
Oh, that's the charge. They've actually added that to the charge.
Wow.
Very exciting.
Well,
very funny too.
Somewhat of our discussion today will be how we shape our narratives, and so you'll help jump in with all that stuff. So that's just great.
I have no pioneer ancestry whatsoever.
Well, it depends how you define pioneer now.
Aha. Yes, that's true. That's true.
That's one of the reasons we wanted to have you on, as somebody from outside the states, outside the corridor, outside that direct, you know, crossing the plains sort of pioneering. And we want to hear how it plays, at least there in New Zealand, and what you've heard from others in the international church and things. But we'll be excited to have that. I also wanted to mention that you have the blog Kiwi Mormon.
Oh,
which
I do
is,
too. Yes.
Which is fantastic, and
it's a must read.
Yes, one of the key blogs that people should subscribe to.
Thank you.
Thanks, pal. All right. Hey, our new guests, and as soon as they start telling their story a little bit, you'll know why we've invited them here. But I'm just going to introduce Joseph and Shalise Johnston. Joseph and I have known each other probably for 18 years or so, and I'll tell a little more about my association with Joseph later. But Joseph and Shalise, would you guys mind introducing yourselves? Just tell us what you do, where you live, a little bit about why I probably had you come on this podcast.
Sure. Ladies first.
I teach high school. I teach English, but I actually majored in history. I don't know how I ended up teaching English, but I love it. I get to play Shakespeare every day. And we live in a little town that's about 15 miles south of Nauvoo. And we met doing a reenactment wagon train in 1997 from Omaha to Salt Lake.
Yes, you did. The sesquicentennial reenactment. And if I remember right, I know, Joseph, you walked it. You weren't on a wagon, right?
Right.
Shalise, I don't remember your mode of transportation or conveyance.
I walked. I also learned how to drive a team of mules.
Awesome.
Which has come in very handy as a high school teacher.
Great. Joseph, do you want to add a little bit more about like what you do for a living and things like that, and then whatever else, and just sort of the overview way about the trek?
Well, being in a nice small town in West Central Illinois, everybody does multiple things. I do graphic design and make brochures and things like that. I also give tours of Nauvoo and Hancock County.
Yes, and in fact, that's one of the ones that I've been on. Now, here's something I really didn't know. I know you give private tours to friends, and you sort of the murders and intrigue of Nauvoo kind of tour. But
the non-work and the glory tour. Yes.
Awesome.
Nice. The racy tour.
Yeah, so I've been on that, but that can't be the only tour that you probably tell. Is that one just for friends and you actually like make some money as a tour guide for the more regular type history?
Yes, yes. Cool. I do show spiritual sites too.
Okay, cool.
Just spiritual life sites.
Anyway, we love having you guys on, and we will dig into your stories and what led you to go on that reenactment and to sort of, you know, the role that Pioneer Heritage plays in your lives, as well as the fact that you guys are right there. And Joseph, I guess maybe what I ought to say a little bit is those few years that I knew you before that you did the trek, you were just this amazingly energetic guy who would come into Benchmark Books where I'd work, and you were reading journals and books and Pioneer stuff. So I knew you as this enthusiast and this real, you know, student of the stuff prior to you doing that and all that stuff. And so I know you know not just the mythological, you know, stories of the pioneers and sort of the constructed narrative, but you've got a real feel for the complexity, and I know you do too, Shalise. So I'm excited to hear how you guys, you know, negotiate those two worlds and the tug of each one. So anyway, well, if we don't mind diving in, Joanna, I thought I would ask you to start first with that bit about the strong women in your background and how they've shaped your identity. It's some of the things that are certainly in your book, some of the things that you've shared at Mormon Stories events and things like that. But for those who haven't heard or need a reminder, I would just love you to kind of riff a little bit on pioneer women in your life and why you have such affection and how it really did help you through that time when you were away from the church a bit.
Sure. You know, I don't come from status Mormons. My father's side of the family were all converts. They converted in Arizona in the 1920s. They moved there to work in the copper mines and to pick cotton. So they were converts there. My mother's mother, though, my grandmother, America, her first name was America, Pearl Dorton, comes from a long line of Utah pioneers and Southern Idaho pioneers that stretches back to England and to New England. And my mother is a very devoted genealogist. So I really grew up with a sense of some of those pioneer ancestors. And it was always a very important legacy for me, and particularly the way my family told the story. And in my mind, it always focused on the women. I can trace, you know, my grandmother's line back to a family in upstate New York, Lucy Waterbury, whose mother died when she was about 12 years old. And she sort of disappeared from the family and about 3 or 4 years later arrived in Nauvoo by herself. And there was married and made the trek across the plains with a very young child, my grandmother's grandmother, Rachel Waterbury White, W-I-G-H-T, so part of the White family. And they settled in the Brigham City, Malad area. And from them, my grandmother's family descended. My grandmother was born in Garland, Utah, and they were never status Mormons, never held important callings. My grandmother left Utah in the 1930s after her parents split up, and she and her mother were forced by economic need to move in with some relatives who'd moved to Los Angeles looking for work during the latter part of the Depression. And so growing up in California, you know, my grandmother would always say to me, would always talk to me about my pioneer ancestry and remark on how important it was to know those stories. And so for me, the stories of my pioneer ancestors are about women who have done, who have traveled long miles as seekers, you know, searching, sometimes in heartbreaking circumstances. And, you know, and I know that that's not the entire pioneer story, but that's what my pioneer ancestry has meant to me, is these women in my past who, you know, followed whatever you want to call it, their heart, followed the spirit, followed this leading to seek. And they took care of each other along the way, you know, in the process of that search, you know. And in my book, I talk about how, and I don't think fully go into it, but I was less active for probably, 8 years. And, you know, at about a halfway point, and there were many reasons why, and some of them had to do with just, you know, my own fear and sadness over some of the excommunications in the 1990s, and again, sort of feelings of fear and sadness over the church's involvement in anti-gay marriage, political activity in California, my home state, starting from the year 2000. And I just was alone. And I was living at the time in Texas, in the early 2000s. And I had virtually no Mormon community. I mean, I'd show up at church once in a while with my youngest, Ella, who was a baby, but I'd sort of cry in the pew and it would be embarrassing for everybody. And so I'd just go home. But I started thinking about, my husband's Jewish, as you know, some readers might know. And I started thinking about Passover and the way that Jewish people think about their ancestors' migration around this meal. And so, you know, at probably the high point of my inactivity, I convened a Pioneer Day dinner for all of my non-Mormon friends who were my only friends at my house. And I cooked terrible Mormon food, you know, very cheeky. You know, I'm like, here is the food of my people. You know, there's green jello. There was my grandmother's green jello recipe, which has the sour cream and the cottage cheese and the pineapple, canned pineapple. And there was another dessert of jello, you know, of jello provenance. And there was an iceberg lettuce salad. And there was, you know, funeral potatoes. And there were white rolls of butter. And, you know, and my friends, you know, brought champagne, actually. Like, what do we eat with this? You know, so it was totally, I didn't drink, but it was totally not irreverent, but it was a really fun way for me to connect with this heritage of mine. And I started meditating and reflecting on all the people I knew who were away from the church for various reasons. And I had this dream that, you know, Pioneer Day could be a moment when even those of us who are in some strained relationship to Orthodoxy could touch and celebrate this legacy, this migration, because it is that holiday that straddles, you know, the cultural, the secular, and the spiritual. And so it was for me a very safe place to begin making contact again. And it led to, you know, and I insisted that we all recount stories of pioneer ancestors at the table. So, you know, like Jewish people recount during Seder, you know, the story of the migration. So, yeah, I think at one point I was dreaming that, you know, in my isolation, when I was still sort of in my period of less activity, I was dreaming that Pioneer Day could be a touch point for people who felt separated from the Orthodox LDS community for whatever reason, that we could have Pioneer Day picnics where gay Mormons and, you know, and unorthodox folks and anyone who felt left out could sort of get together and touch this again and keep each other company as we made our own long journey. So, you know, my Pioneer Day for me has been pretty precious ever since then. And I've always managed to cook that horrible food, which horrifies my husband.
I've been to a Seder and I didn't particularly enjoy the food.
You have a problem with gefilte fish? What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? Yeah, well, you know, so it's been a sweet thing in my life, but we've done it in a different way. We've put our own spin on it. For me, it's been about these women ancestors who cared for one another during difficult times when their own leadings led them somewhere unfamiliar. So, you know, I'd love to hear, you know, other people in the program talk about, you know, how we do represent this Pioneer Day legacy today and how it's spun, you know, the work in the glory version versus, you know, the more marginal or alternative versions like mine.
Awesome. And no comment. Thank you for the story. One thing that you did remind me of just there a minute or two ago when you talked about maybe there could be other ways to celebrate pioneers if you're a gay Mormon or something, it reminded me that I was going to mention that on this July 24th, Mormons Building Bridges, through their website, are selling bumper stickers. And they are basically asking everybody who buys one to wait until July 24th to put them on their vehicle or whatever and to take a picture of it, and sort of a show of solidarity of these Mormons who are trying to affirm LGBT folks and you know, be a voice for love and acceptance and stuff like that within the church, sort of embracing the fact that that's a pioneering role that they're playing. So
I love it. I love it.
Yeah, I wanted to shout out to that. So anybody can go to Mormons Building Bridges. I'm sure you can just Google it. I don't know the website, but maybe there's still time to get yourself a bumper sticker. Joseph and Shalise, I'd love to turn to you guys next to tell a little bit more depth about, I don't know, super depth on, you know, all your ancestors or something like that, but really what it was in your lives that sort of bubbled up into this perfect storm that says, I'm going to walk halfway across the country in 1997 and things like that. So what's that role or what's that tug of the pioneer ancestry that has bitten you guys and even led you now to live in frickin' about as close to Nauvoo as you can?
I'll go first. Mine actually didn't have much to do with my ancestors. I knew I had pioneer ancestors. I also knew I had some black sheep ancestors, and they seemed a little more interesting to me at the time. But ever since I have been a little kid, I have been fascinated with history. When I was 3 years old, I didn't speak to my mother for a week because I wasn't born a pioneer. So
that's great.
I was a weird child. And, you know, I had just finished college. I did actually go on one of those stake youth treks, and that was really, really awful. They gave us water out of a pickle barrel so we would get sick on purpose, so we would understand what our ancestors went through. But I just didn't feel like I wanted to have a more authentic experience, and I wanted to cross the plains. And I wanted to cross it in more than just a car. I wanted to get to know the land, because I think that history and the land are very connected. And so I just finished college. I was substitute teaching, which is always fun, and saw the ad for the wagon train and thought, well, that sounds like fun. Let's go do that.
So okay, cool.
So I ended up doing that.
Cool. Let's let Joseph kind of bring it up to that point now, too, and then I'll ask you a couple more questions, go a little more depth about the connection that maybe has, you know, took root then and lasted, et cetera. So, Joseph, tell us, I mean, you're obviously a little different because I know that you were reading those journals and things before, even for a couple of years before you went. So tell us more.
Yeah, actually, on my mission in Texas, I had, as a Christmas present, my parents mailed to me a copy of my great-great-grandfather's reminiscence. And he had been a missionary almost exactly 150 years before I was. And it was kind of interesting because a lot of the same anti-Mormon stuff he got 150 years before, I was getting 150 years later in Texas. So I used some of the same responses that he did, and they worked just as well. Shut people up all the time. So he and I had a great bonding while I was on my mission. And just as my mission progressed, I was talking with some of the other missionaries and figured out anniversary dates for things and just kind of felt the Spirit whisper to me that I needed to be at the Carthage jail on the 150th anniversary of the martyrdom. And I was there for that and continued studying my great-great-grandfather's journal and so on and so forth. And
do you want to shout out with his name?
Jesse Walker Johnston.
Okay.
Also with the UN.
Okay.
And let's see, I don't know, what else do you want to know? Oh, I guess how I got to the trail. Just became completely enraptured with my great-great-grandfather. It was as if he and his mother kept pestering me all the time. Kept telling me, oh, go to Church Archives today. Oh, go to Benchmark and see what they've got in stock and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I was being led around by the nose by my ancestors, almost. In February of 1996, I was a really geeky young college student, and, well, I guess I wasn't too young by that point.
You're definitely geeky.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was subscribing to the church news and picked up my church news that one Saturday morning and saw a report of the sesquicentennial commemoration of the Exodus from Nauvoo. And I thought, well, that's really cool. And at the end of the article was a little paragraph that said there are going to be two wagon trains leaving Nauvoo this summer. Anybody who's interested can call this number or this number. And I didn't even set that down. I went to the nearest payphone and immediately called one of those numbers. And got a hold of somebody and said, I'm going to be on the wagon train with you. What do I need to bring? And she said, hold it. What's your name? Who are you?
Cool.
And I just knew that I was going to be taking my great-great-grandfather's part, Jesse Walker Johnston's part, in marching in the 24th of July celebration, the big parade, for in 1997 for the 150th anniversary. He had been a Mormon battalion member, had gotten sick along the way, and came into the Salt Lake Valley 4 days after Brigham Young did. And so I was bound and determined I was going to honor his memory, and didn't know how it was going to happen, but I thought this wagon train might be a good possibility. I grew my hair out to honor him because he had long hair 150 years before, you know, and there we go.
And she married you anyway, man.
Yes, she married me anyway.
Yep. I love his long hair. I made him grow it out again.
Cool. No, so that's fun. So you guys just ended up chatting as you walked along, and love bloomed. And you can tell more about that story, but it was really neat. I got to attend you guys' wedding reception there at This Is the Place State Park. And you guys just, you know, felt to me like people who really, this became important to you guys.
Yeah, yes, it was something very important to the both of us, yes. And I'll tell you what, it was the most successful singles program the church has ever had.
Oh, really? You weren't the only ones?
Every single eligible bachelor that was on that wagon train got married to a girl he either met along the way or got to know much better.
Very cool.
Every single one of them, 100%.
Don't say that too loud to the brethren, because they're looking for that. Anyway, awesome. Well, we'll get a little bit more into how the idealization plays out in your life and versus the realities and stuff a little bit. But I wanted to give Gina a chance to do either of a couple things. Gina, Joanna kind of hinted that if you want to talk about your own pioneer ancestry within the New Zealand church or whatever, if you want to, or, you know, however your heritage and whatnot plays out in your life that way. But then also feel free to jump in either instead of or in addition to about, you know, whenever July 24th rolls around in New Zealand, do you guys even notice? Or does the church's magazines? Yeah, does the church's magazines force you to and you all scratch your head or what? So just let you roll for a minute.
Oh, well, as I said, we don't have any American pioneer ancestry, but the first people to join the church in New Zealand was my great-great-great-grand aunt. And I think she joined the church in about 1893 up in the Bay of Islands. That's in the Northland of, so that's, we've got a South Island and a North Island. That's kind of the north of the North Island. I don't know what happened to her, but the next group of people to join were my grandparents in the 1940s. And they joined the church up on the east coast of the North Island in a place called Te Araroa. And that's kind of what my history looks like. In terms of the kind of impact that things like Pioneer Day makes in New Zealand, it's probably quite negligible, to be honest. I don't want to be offensive. I sort of, when you mentioned Pioneer Day, Dan, I said to my husband, what the hell is Pioneer Day? We kind of got on and had a look at it and thought, oh, that looks like fun. The only thing that we, like in the sesquicentennial year, our state president struck on the notion that we should all reenact a pioneer trail and get dressed up in pioneer clothes and push handmade hand carts around the foreshore of Banks Peninsula, which wasn't easy because, you know, it's all very sandy. I withdrew from it on kind of, you know, kind of political and cultural reasons. Those reasons, I thought it was just a bit barking mad, actually. And when we kind of looked at it, there were all these, you know, Māoris with all these pioneer hats pretending to be Americans. It just seemed a bit odd.
Yeah.
Celebrate our own pioneer ancestry, which is quite different. You know, well, there weren't these sort of, you know, there were, our pioneer ancestry was more about sort of ocean going voyages rather than, you know, kind of land voyages and. And it's all an economy of scales, you know. If a Mormon convert were to gather, I mean, we were supposed to gather like in the 20th century. I think the expectation was that we would gather to Utah, but that was obviously ocean going, and then to San Francisco, and then overland. So it was kind of coming from the opposite direction. I don't know if that gets celebrated a great deal. I don't know, does it in Utah? Do you talk about the pioneers coming from that direction, or is it just always going to the west?
Well, we know, you know, there's wonderful research that's been done in, oh, Gene, I forget the name, by a professor at the University of Hawaii who has talked about Pacific Islander pioneers who were brought into Utah to...
It's R. Lanier Bridge.
Yeah. Yeah. In the city of Aosepa, which was, you know, abandoned, and how they were not respected, and they haven't been included. And actually, at the PCC, there is a small monument, a very small monument, hiding behind another building to these, you know, pioneers from the Pacific who came to Utah. But other than that, I've never seen it celebrated.
Yeah, I don't think it's celebrated, but I do think families have done it. There was recently that ship that sailed from Denmark with descendants. I'm guessing it's, what, 5 or 6 years ago? Joseph, do you remember? Always feel free to jump in and help me with my history or something. But I know that they did, families and whatnot joined that and sailed over here as close to the conditions as their Danish saints did. So there was at least some ocean-going thing. And I know that there's a book called Saints on the High Seas or something that we used to sell, or that I used to sell when I was at Benchmark. Joseph, do you remember any of the other titles, maybe?
I think you've got the right title. I can't remember the author. I know it has a blue cover.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so Gina, I don't know so much. I do think there has been a broadening of, you know, the influx of saints to Zion from whatever means. And so I think there's a bit of an embrace of that. But certainly it isn't quite the same as the oxen and all the different other types of things, and burying people on the plains with a spoon, you know, or something, you know, those kinds of things that get a little bit strangely placed into our consciousness. So thank you, Gina, on that. Let me, I do want to ask, though, you said you opted out of that reenactment sort of on political grounds. Did it end up being a bust for those that were there, or did you get a sense that even this forced clash of trying to adopt the American experience into the consciousness or to seep in, was it strengthening to anybody there?
I think the people who did it enjoyed it. They invited the press to come. And so there was these odd pictures of, you know, people that I went to church with dressed like Americans crossing, you know, trying to push handcarts through the sand. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it would have been like. I thought it was a little bit embarrassing, actually. It's not that we don't tell those stories and think that they're important, particularly, you know, out here. It's, you know, there's a way of mythologizing it out here as an important endowment to us, like what the pioneers did.
Oh, good. That's interesting.
To give us the gospel. But it just seemed odd to be doing that. So I don't know what non-members made of it.
Okay. So there is a sense, at least, of the New Zealand Saints honoring the faith and the you know, the hardships and stuff, because without that, the religion never could have come to New Zealand and been the blessing that it is in your lives and things. But that whole forcing the American experience upon you guys a bit less so.
Yes, yes. Oh,
cool. And from what I've heard around the world from folks in other countries and whatnot who are there, there is sort of this sense of there have been efforts, and it seemed like the church wasn't super aware that, you know, Pioneer Day and Mormon Pioneer Emphasis wouldn't play well in Great Britain and other stuff the way that it does here. And I get the impression that there was a lot of head scratching and a lot of sort of almost laughing or sort of, you know, what are you guys trying to do here stuff. And I get a sense from those that I've talked to that maybe the church has become more aware that this doesn't translate internationally in exactly the same way, and it seems like maybe the rhetoric and the sort of in-your-face emphasis on it and everybody have this similar experience seems to be going away. Is that a general impression that any of you are getting?
You know, I don't know outside the country, but I do know on the wagon train, there were several people who didn't have pioneer ancestry. They were just really interested in doing this historical reenactment. And oftentimes people would come on the wagon train and they would talk about, you know, their ancestor was so-and-so, and they'd do a lot of dropping of names, or suspiciously their ancestor was always part of the Willie Handcart Company. We won't talk about how it's two companies, but anyway. And, you know, there was this young man with us who was starting to feel a little left out. He didn't know who his ancestors were. He was from Kansas. And he kind of felt like, well, gee, I guess I'm a nobody because I don't have all these famous ancestors. And after learning a little bit of history of the church, you know, one day a lady kind of got in his face about her ancestors. And I know that she was proud of them, and she wasn't trying to be mean. It just kind of was in your face. And he just had kind of had it. And he said, well, you know, I do have an ancestor. They're from Missouri, last name of Boggs.
Oh, my heck.
Oh.
And I don't think the lady even got it, but those of us who did get it just thought it was hilarious. But, you know, and living outside of the Zion Curtain, you know, you have a lot of people who say, well, you know, I don't have pioneer ancestry, so this really doesn't matter to me. And I say to them, but you have ancestry. And every ancestor you have is a pioneer in some way. They may have, right. You know, you have immigrant ancestors that came to this country. It may have been on the Mayflower. It may have been last week. Whenever it is, you still have ancestors, and those experiences that your ancestors had are still part of who you are, whether or not it's a church. So anyway.
Yeah, I do think that that's how the rhetoric shifted, and not just whether they came here to America, but I really do think there has been an improvement of saying something like, even to Gina, or people there, think of the pioneering of those early converts in your country who never came, you know, to quote-unquote Zion, you know.
Yeah,
so.
I know as a kid growing up in Arizona, I remember, you know, it was the era of Little House on the Prairie. And every 24th of July, we would have big parades around the chapel. And, you know, it was a huge deal in Arizona. But now living in Illinois, it's just another day of the week. And nobody pays attention to it at all, really. There may be a primary thing if it happens to fall on the primary day or something like that. But it's minimally celebrated now.
Why is that? Is that just because of political tensions about ownership and Nauvoo and surrounding area. I mean, I know that it's not like the most peaceful, apolitical scene there.
Fill us in.
Well, for out there, yeah, you know, people who would be celebrating the 24th of July, they all went west.
Okay. Okay. So the fact that Nauvoo and the idealization and Mormon consciousness, the people who live there, they're just past yeah. that?
Well, yeah, for the most part, the people who are there in Nauvoo, for most of them, have little or nothing to do with the church. And then those who are members are, well, for a lot of them, they are transplants from Utah. Well, some of them wanting to be even more Utah than Utah. But that's an entirely different podcast.
Okay.
And yeah, it just doesn't seem to be a really big thing, I guess, because it's the head of the trail rather than the end of the trail.
Okay. Interesting.
Could I just ask?
Occasionally they talk about the two temples facing each other, Nauvoo and Salt Lake, but that's pretty much most of the focus, I think, in Nauvoo is on Joseph and the saints and being driven out, and then that's kind of where it ends, and they kind of figure you'll pick up the rest of the story later.
Right. Gina, you wanted to jump in.
I'm not being facetious, but I was just wondering, because a lot of our mythologizing about this trek westward, you know, begins at Nauvoo and ends at Salt Lake City. So those people living in Nauvoo, do they kind of feel constantly sort of inscripted into a story where they actually haven't made it yet? Do you know what
left
I mean?
Left behind. It's like the original Left Behind.
Yeah. Do you feel left behind?
No, not really. Not really. Okay. There are times when I do feel like I am picking up my namesakes being sold into Egypt, but not really left behind, not really, no.
Okay.
What led you two to choose to live there? Because I know that's not where you're both from.
I didn't want to raise my kids in Utah.
Okay. a familiar ring to that for many people, I bet.
I also... And then this is a different podcast entirely, too. Being an educator in Utah is incredibly difficult. You're nothing more than a glorified babysitter, and I really wanted to.
Okay. Class size and all that, yeah, and pay, yeah.
So I can do that where I am.
And I really just felt the spirit of gathering. It was very strong and very powerful and almost overwhelming at times that is where we needed to be, is we needed to live in the Nauvoo area. Not necessarily the city, but in that area there.
Right. Well, from whatever I can contribute, you Buzz are a wonderful asset to that area, and I'm glad that you're there, especially when I come. But
yeah.
Anyway, well, thank you for that. You guys, I want to move into the next section of the podcast, is sort of this area of, you know, the way the pioneer story has become mythologized. We've pretty much so far had very positive, you know, strength is gathered from our pioneer ancestry and things like that. And we've kind of focused on that. But there is this sort of element sometimes of when you over-idealize, or if you tell a story in a way in order to do, like Gina's charged with, to tell the faith-promoting, you know, aspects of her stake there in New Zealand, or just anytime you're told to do that, you end up leaving out a lot of the human drama, the complexity, and you focus on certain things, but then people forget about that, and it becomes this burdensome thing. So there's this wonderful Linda Sillitoe essay that I'll definitely link to. It's called The Ghost of the Pioneer Woman. And she just talks, you know, in this essay about all the different ways that women, especially in the church for her, she says, you know, here's this, we know who she was. She crossed prairies, cooked biscuits over a campfire, bore children without anesthetic under a leaky cabin roof. Her faith did not falter when her children died of plague, her husband took other wives for godly reasons, or he became a foreign missionary for several years. This is because he was engaged in his father's business, so she became competent breadwinner. Within our living vision, she can still split rails or go to East to medical school. She is midwife healer, seamstress, and bakes wonderful bread. You know, so we hear that, and then she even goes on and talks about it, different eras of Mormon stuff. The pioneer woman became somebody else. She was the one who fought Joseph on polygamy. She was the one who fought for women's rights, who wanted the gifts of the Spirit to survive within women's things. Pretty soon she became the jogger, the one who does everything and stuff like that. And it's all, she ties us into this mythology of this perfect people who then kind of haunt us in our present because we can't measure up to these ideals. And of course she then takes it into a really neat way, and so she sort of reclaims some of these ancestors from her own life as she talks about them, and she says how they've begun to serve as healers or as people that, instead of judging them from the other side of the veil, have shifted to now where they're the ones that they know would understand the trials that women are going to today because their lives were so much more complex in real life. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about stylized narration, all this sort of stuff, and the good and the bad of this. So I'd love to just have Joanna, your turn to talk again. I'd love to have you just play in that area for a while.
Well, you know, and I'm sort of a storyteller by nature and profession in some respects. And, you know, there's two ways to think about how to tell a story. And there's this old notion that you tell a story in a way that's faithful to some original set of events. And then there's another notion that, you know, you basically steal from the past whatever you can carry forward, you know, and maybe steal is the wrong word, but just, you know, you take from it what you need. The story depends as much upon the community it's being told in right now, you know. So you tell the story forward rather than feeling like you have to be faithful to some idealized past. And that's always really spoken to me. Not that we're not trying to be truthful. I mean, you want to be truthful. I mean, the good thing for me is that when I go to my actual pioneer ancestry, I don't find heroes necessarily. You know, I have a great ancestor named Elizabeth Sims who shows up in the family history. I mean, she converted from a very, very first rural and then a newly industrialized working class family in England, in the Manchester Stockport area of England, and insisted on dragging a trunk of teas across the plain with her. And I don't think those were upscale teas, because there's a copy of her patriarchal blessing that survives that says that cautions her against being a gossip. So, you know, I always look at her as being, you know, possibly one of these converts for whom there was a sense that the gospel or that Mormonism held this very alive sense of relationship to the divine or to the spiritual, right? She was more of a spiritualist, right? That's what I see. And that she was enfolded in this gathering, you know, a gossip and a tea using midwife. I mean, that's basically, you know, you're a wise woman in her own indigenous English tradition, and somehow Mormonism enfolded her and the grandeur of the Mormon vision brought her across. And then I have, you know, and she wasn't really happy in Idaho. There's no secret in the family history about that. But I love that image of, you know, the grandeur of history and of these characters that were all united by this dream of Zion, however it played out. You know, I find in other books, you know, I have ancestors who helped settle Lehi, the name Dorton. If you have real history buffs, they might know Dorton's connected to Lehi. And I find in Richard Burton's City of the Saints, you know, my Dorton ancestors, like, you know, my great-great-grandmother threatening to cut off his ears if he took a polygamous wife, and they're sitting in a haystack drinking beer. So, I mean, these are normal people in my history.
Oh, that's good. That's healthy. Yeah.
You know, like these are characters, and but they are characters who made some pretty, you know, there's something in the physical strength and in the determination and in the willingness to live for a vision that I've been able to draw on. You know, I mean, maybe it's sort of an adaptation or an outlaw version of pioneer history, but it's one that's fueled me since I'm of a more independent spirit.
Well, that's good. So you have not really faced that whole idea of a judging idealized character that might be criticizing you in the way you're doing your thing here. But I'm sure that you're aware that it does happen, that there are these families that will destroy a pioneer journal or something because of confessions of a loss of faith or when things for fear that, you know, today's descendants will not be strengthened. And, you know, so we know that that sort of thing happens.
We were always low classy Mormons. So, We were at peace with our own renegade quality until my parents' generation.
Oh, then it shifted?
Oh, yeah. My parents were far more observant than their parents.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Absolutely.
And they would... Okay, interesting. Joseph and Shalice, how would you guys like to talk about knowing that there is this mythologizing and yet being very aware through your own reading and you're actually paying the price to find out about the complexity and sort of embodying and stuff, you know, pieces of this. So I'm sure when you read things, it feels differently to you than maybe it does to some of us because of having, you know, that connection with the land and walking on it over your own feet and stuff like that. So how do you guys play that between the two worlds of the mythological saint and the true human being, and, you know, and then reflect however you'd like to on how you see that dynamic playing out, not only in just your life, but in the church today?
Well, I'll answer the first part. I'll let Shalice answer the second part. Having done a fair amount of historical research before the wagon train, I knew that hand carts were evil and should never be touched. I read enough journals from people who had used them to know that they were the most hated instrument that ever crossed the plains. People preferred wheelbarrows over hand carts.
Really?
And the, boy, what's the word I'm looking for? The idealization of the sacrifices of our ancestors has the Madonna of the Prairies kind of image has just gone so overboard that these people who crossed the plains have become absolutely mythic. They've been the new version of the gods on Mount Olympus. They could do no wrong, and like you were saying, just modern-day descendants destroy their journals. One of the most important things that I have learned is that these were regular people. These were regular people doing something extraordinary.
That's nice.
They were regular people who liked to listen to music, who liked to go dancing, who liked to have somebody else cook for them.
They gossiped.
Yes, and gossip.
Like sleeping in their own bed. Not all of them liked to rough it. Not all of them were the Porter Rockwell type.
But, of course, they never complained. They never complained about their lot in life.
They regularly complained about their lot in life. That really bothers me with how people 150 years ago are now represented. 160, 170 years ago are represented.
When did the real, historically, in Mormon history, when did this idealization of our pioneer ancestors start happening? I mean, Michael Gilmore, who is not LDS anymore, grew up in Gary Gilmore's brother, wrote this book called Shot in the Heart and said, you know, all these pioneer ancestor legends cover up for the fact that these were all, you know, he used some choice words about how they were all very tough people and ornery. So when does the idealization of Mormon pioneer history start? Do you know?
I would bet that it would be about the time of Brigham Young's death.
When we forget
maybe
that a
even
lot of
before
them
were that, with the coming of the railroad,
yeah.
It really seemed to have taken on more of a sacred nature then. Right as that generation died out, that's when people started really lionizing their ancestors, even though it was just their parents.
Well, and then think about, you know, my parents' generation in the 50s, what were the popular TV shows and what were the, you know, Howdy Doody and Bonanza and Little House on the Prairie, and where the pioneer lifestyle is so idolized on those that you think that it's, oh, it's just this wonderful thing. And so I think that media, not just, you know, not church-wise, but media helps perpetuate this idea. You see it in the movies, and there are these rugged individuals who cross the plains and can shoot straight and
dig a bullet out of their own arm.
Yeah.
Well,
get birth, grab the baby, we gotta go, you know.
It's so important to track, you know, I mean, there's 1,000 dissertations on things like this, but to track the way a culture uses its own mythology at different points during its own history. I mean, there's a, you know, a killer Mormon studies dissertation right there. When did the pioneers start getting all sacredized instead of looking like the human beings that they actually were?
Yeah, well, it was right about that same time that the what would it have been? The juvenile instructor and the women's exponent started doing this series on the prophet Joseph Smith, all these great reminiscences about his life and few sayings and people's interactions with him. That seems to be right about the same time that people's parents were idealized, that they started coming away with, oh no, my parents never drank tea in their entire lives.
Ha ha.
Yeah. That kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some things I think are misinterpreted. You know, I remember seeing pictures of women on wagon trains on the prairie and they're ironing their clothes. And I'm thinking, are you serious? Are you insane? Why are you ironing your clothes? And when we were on the wagon train, we had a group of people who were trying to live very authentic. And so they had the soap, the old soap, the recipe, and they washed their clothes in that. And they kind of took the attitude, well, I'm not ironing. Are you kidding me? And found out very quickly that the clothes chafe them and leave marks. But if you actually iron them, there's some kind of chemical reaction that happens with the heat that takes that out of the clothes. Makes them less like sandpaper. And So sometimes I think we misunderstand what we see in the pictures or maybe even the journal because we haven't experienced that. You know, I would never have known that that particular kind of soap does that.
Fascinating.
Sometimes I think we see those and we think, well, gee, that look at that woman. She'll iron even on the planes. Well, there's a reason for that. She didn't want to have sore marks under her arms.
Well, I think, too, just thinking about this trope of pictures, you know, and thinking about how this mythology of our pioneers applies across the history of the church, you know, it's important, too, also to think about what's left out of any given picture in the past. And, I mean, the fact is that as much as we love to idealize that, you know, Mormon pioneer trek was a part of a westward movement that was colonial and that, you know, appropriated land from indigenous people. I know that all sounds simplistic, but it's just a fact of history, you know, and I wonder how that plays out given that, you know, missionary expansion, the church is now, it's in a first world position and large percentage of the population of the church is now in the global South. And, you know, how that adds wrinkles and ironies in to the way pioneer history has been transmitted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I have a question.
We like to think our ancestors were only friendly, you know, to Native people.
Right.
That, you know, we were different, you know.
Well, I don't know about your ancestors, but mine were only friendly.
Oh, whatever. I mean, by you, forget it.
I think we need to remember, though, that this cohort of people, these converts that went particularly from Europe or from England out, you know, out to the United States were the same group of people that were going elsewhere in their colonies. And to get an idea of their character, you know, the kind of people they were, it's, you know, that they weren't in a bubble. You know, they carried all their cultural traits, you know, across the plains in the same way that they carried their cultural traits in a 3-month journey from England down to New Zealand. So I think part of our mythologizing is to expect that there is something incredibly different or transformed about them, which is not to say that they didn't have a, you know, they weren't spiritually inclined or anything, but, you know, cultural traits follow. And, you know, if they were going to take land off Māori in New Zealand or, you know, colonize Aboriginal land in Australia, they were certainly not above doing it elsewhere. So,
yeah. And I got to tell you, one of my favorite pioneer journals of all time is Abner Blackburn's. And Abner Blackburn has this great story in there of on the wagon train he was going across, and there was this young couple who had fallen in love, and when they got to Independence Rock, and Blackburn puts this in his journal, the camp got tired of them licking on each other and forced them to get married there at Independence Rock.
Terrific.
Just regular people, you know, teenagers have always been teenagers. They will always be teenagers.
And they'll always lick on each other.
Oh, man, I didn't expect that image for this podcast. I love it. Thank you.
And I know that I'm a big Shakespeare fan, so you'll have to forgive me here. But the thing that he was so good at was capturing what it means to be human and taking those emotions that we can feel across the centuries. And if you're doing those things, like destroying those journals that take out those emotions and take out the imperfections, you're missing so much. It's a great comfort to me to know that there are men and women who have gone before me who have gone through similar things, who have had feelings of jealousy, who have had feelings of doubt in the cause that they're involved in, who have...
Snuck a beer.
Yes, snuck a beer. Who have gossiped, you know, who have thought, oh my gosh, she's wearing that dress. But if you take all that out, I think it actually does a disservice to the people who came before us, because you're taking away that human part of them, which is part of us.
Oh, pioneers were jerks too. I think it's liberating to say it.
Yeah.
Well, everybody, yeah. 1, 2, 3.
Good job. They were jerks too.
Awesome. Gina, I want to just have
you. Love them.
Oh, good. Yes, absolutely. And love them even more. Carl, how do you?
Because I'm a jerk, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yep, exactly.
Absolutely.
Gina, and
you know,
please. You're not going to let me throw to Gina.
I'm going to throw this one out there for Gina because my favorite pioneer story of all time is not the common one that you would think of. As I mentioned, I would go to church archives and I would pull up the microfilm on my great-great-grandfather's reminiscence there. And scrolling through, it's one of the last things on the roll of microfilm. Scrolling through, my hand would get tired, and so I'd sit and wait. And one day came across this other reminiscence of a man on this microfilm, and it was a man from Cambodia who had escaped from Pol Pot, crossing the fields, and it was just a remarkable story of his escape. And how when he got to the Philippines, he heard some missionaries there. And it was just an incredibly touching and moving story. And that is literally my favorite pioneer story of all time.
Hmm.
You know, there are pioneers in every country, in every climate. You know, it's not just those who cross the plains from 1846 to 1869. Pioneering just doesn't stop, and it doesn't have a zip code.
Definitely lessons that we should hear and stuff. I do think the church rhetoric is going that direction, so I'm glad for that. But Gina, I wanted to stay theoretical for a minute, okay? So I'm going to throw it to you and Joanna with your background and, you know, in storytelling and narrative too. I want you guys to at least... We've talked about how this mythologizing, and I think we've mostly said it's bad. We talk about how humanizing is generally, you know, more healthy for us in the present. Is there anything in your awareness from your studies of discourse and narrative shifts and whatnot that kind of could lead our listeners to have an opening or some way of complexifying things in a good way that might be heard? Is there some lesson from the world of how
jerks is not enough? Saying that they were jerks is not,
probably not going to go over well.
Liberating paradigm.
I guess I'm just trying to say is I want a practical way that, you know, this coming week or two, as we're in our Sunday services and these things might get there, maybe there's going to be an opening for us to humanize or whatever. And I'm just kind of wondering if there's things from your backgrounds in the academy and the things you've watched about the ways that discourses can shift and turn, and if there are tricks to the trade. I don't. Maybe this is a terrible question.
Gosh, that's a big question, isn't it? I think, like, speaking theoretically, I think the emphasis of one story in any cultural context is really problematic. And this pioneer story has often been a universal for Mormonism. So no matter where we are in the world, we open our curriculum materials and we have to tell stories of pioneers. We also have to sing songs, you know, and there's all those geographic kind of sort of directionals,
yeah.
Like everyone's moving west. And like, if we moved west, we'd be on the west coast, and that's not a place to be desired to go, you know. And so it's in our hymn books. It's this sort of mythologizing of something west. And I have to ask a question. Is And I think Joanna talked about this before. Is that because is the emphasis on the pioneer story about piggybacking on a larger sort of nationalistic sort of, you know, story of expansion? Is it just is it perhaps Mormonism trying to find some validity and being part of that, those national stories? I don't know.
I think we have an extremely exceptionalist view of Mormonism's place in American colonialism. And it's something we need to think about pretty carefully. You know, there are lots of folk stories we tell ourselves about the way that Mormons in Utah established a different kind of relationship to local indigenous people that's not necessarily borne out by history, by the historical facts. I'm not saying it was equivalent or the same, but it wasn't necessarily better. But we have this, I think, exceptionalist view of our own history. I don't see it as piggybacking on, oh, how the West was won, you know, but it's not examined.
Right, right. Okay, so I wanted to get back to how problematic it is to have a universal story for all of Mormonism, aside from the fact that, you know, we have to negotiate this. You know, out at the periphery, we're constantly negotiating with these old stories. Where do I fit in with all of this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, not having that pioneer ancestry. And I think it's also problematic because it creates a class system. I think Joanna talked about not having status pioneers. And the whole
"You Daughters of the Utah Pioneer" thing here, was prestige to be able to prove your bona fides to be part of that.
Yes. And I suppose there are tiers to that. There are, you know, status Mormons, you know, be your elite group, and then those who are sort of middling ones who came out, and then there would be those who, you know, joined when it was just, you know, easier to travel across the plains, and then they're kind of later converts, and then there's us out on the periphery, and I suppose when you continue sort of telling these stories, when these stories continue, that it makes those on the periphery feel that they're only partially Mormon,
right.
That, you know, their identity is bound to, if a Mormon identity is bound to these stories, then I'm only a little bit Mormon. I'm not entirely Mormon.
And I recall
we were at church in Manila a couple of years ago, and they had some missionaries. Lots of missionaries from the United States were staffing the Manila temple, and they were in our ward. And I think my husband and I raised this. We were just kind of curious, like, what is the deal with you Utah Mormons always talking about pioneers? And one good old boy, I think he was from Texas, and he just sort of launched forth at how marginalized he felt because he was a convert, and I think he was from Utah. And that becomes deeply problematic, I think. And that's not to say from the beauty of the story, but you know, I think that exceptionalism and you know the closeness of that story is worrisome.
Go over where you want, any of you, on Gina's points, but at some point in this, I want you to at least try my question about how have you, maybe it's just the question of how have you had success in expanding somebody's view to see that idealization is wrong and maybe isn't the, I mean, not wrong is not the right word, but not less than ideal. Idealization is less than ideal. So, add that in somewhere. Yeah.
I'll give it a shot because, you know, when I was listening, I mean, I love breaking a story down, a big pageant-like story down, and getting it into its unexpected parts that reveal, you know, things that are pleasurable and human and inspiring in unexpected ways that really matter to this moment. And, you know, when you were talking about ways to sort of subvert may be too strong a word, but to deal if we start hearing these, you know, lionized, idealized recountings of our alabaster pioneer ancestors, you know, we're
awesome.
So marvelous, you know. there's something about taking pleasure in a story. And, you know, Mormons are still humans to this point. And perhaps there are Mormons who only take pleasure in alabaster and perfect. But, you know, there's a lot of people love Porter Rockwell stories as well. And, you know, I think if we each kind of search out these unlikely human mold busting aspects of our own histories, you know, that don't necessarily comport with the idealized depiction that the Johnstons are suggesting took root after the death of Brigham Young, after the pioneers actually died and people got to forget that they were human beings. But if we can draw out that humanity and take pleasure in it and tell stories that people will take pleasure in and, you know, talk about your great, great, great grandfather who was drinking beer in a haystack in China, put a spell on his neighbor for, you know, and who dug a well on the top of a hill, duh, rather than near the high. This is all true. Top of a hill, he dug the well. And then, like, he's in City of the Saints, like, trying to bewitch a neighbor with some old piece of English folk magic. And you just know Utah was way more interesting than this alabaster history. And we're still rascals and scoundrels, and we're still human beings, and Mormons are still fighting for, Mormons of all stripes and colors really are still fighting for a humane, humanizing depiction of ourselves in the media at this time. You know, it's all split between this, you know, perfection and, you know, abasement. You know, either we're totally weird or we're perfect and corporate, you know, and somewhere in the middle, there's a humanness to this religious tradition. So, you know, if I can find those stories, and clearly my past is full of them, my ancestry is full of them, that draw on the unexpected, that admit that, you know, some of the ancestors who crossed the plains were gossips who dragged trunks of teas, you know, and caused trouble, but they're bona fide part of the history of this faith tradition. They did help build it, and there's got to be a place for all of us in it. So tell the wild stories, and just, because people will love them. People will still love them. We'll take pleasure in them. We'll just recenter the pleasure or decenter the pleasure and say the only way to take pleasure in pioneer history is not to feel all prim and, you know, holy, but also human and led.
Beautiful. Hey, there's a final section, and I don't want us to keep us too much longer on the podcast. So, Johnstons, feel free to jump in on any of that at the beginning of this, but I'm going to throw to you guys first. And that is to talk a little bit about what you see going on with this practice, I guess, over the last couple decades of these youth treks, of trying in 2 to 3 days to create experiences where there'd be a taste and a deeper appreciation among today's youth for these aspects of Mormon history and things like that. And I know that you guys, you know, have feelings about these particular things. And so I want to give you any chance you want to frame both good and bad on these things and just let you go.
Well, as a mother, if I want to teach my children to respect my ancestors, I'm not going to send them on one of those. I'm going to tell them the stories that make them human. I'm going to tell them about how when, you know, she's not a pioneer ancestor, but how my grandma, when I was 3, I thought my name was Little Shit because that's what my grandma called me. Yeah, I'm going to tell them that, and I'm going to tell them the human side of it.
What?
Can she say that on your podcast?
I think I've said it at least several times.
That's what I'm going to tell them.
Edition of Mormon Otters.
That's right. When I listened on iTunes, do I have to put the explicit banner now this year?
This time? Yeah. That's awesome.
Leave it to me to make it explicit. But I wouldn't send my children on that. I don't think that it does them any good. At least my experience with it, like I said, was they put the water in an old pickle bottle. And that's what we were supposed to drink and made us all sick. And then it was almost like they thought it was funny and they walked us around in circles. And, you know, yeah, I appreciate that they had to walk a lot, but come on.
Yeah, our pioneers were not idiots.
Yeah.
You know, they were real people who had just as much brain capacity as we do today. True, they didn't have forge to drive them across the plains, but they knew how to walk. They knew how to raise stones 6 stories in the air. These were people who knew how to use their brains, and they did. You know, they didn't put water in dirty pickle barrels. They didn't intentionally go and make themselves sick to prove how righteous they were.
It sounds like these treks, Your Honor, like those survival, you know, abusive survival camps in southern Utah where they send wayward teenagers.
Yeah.
That's really how these things are being run? It's crazy.
And I think that that's where these survival camps got the idea from.
Yeah, they've been around longer than the trek phenomenon, I think. But I
just see them as a false spiritual experience. You know, they
well, right. It's definitely a manufactured moment. Yeah.
Yeah. They take kids to their complete emotional breaking point, and they call their physical and emotional distress a spiritual experience and tell kids, well, that's spirit talking to you. But that's completely not what's going on. And I think it does far more harm than it does good.
Okay. For those who don't know about it, let me at least share my daughter's experience, which was a very positive one for her. I don't think it did any permanent damage to her or stuff. But among the things that they do is, for instance, on the first night there's a young mother that brings her little baby. And she passes it around, and isn't this baby cute, and da-da-da-da-da. And then guess what? The next couple of days they let you know that baby has died in order to try to give you the experience of what it would be like to have familiar with somebody in your company that died. Yeah, so that's one of the things they do. And then there's, you know, obviously you kill a couple of chickens. Each of the wagon train families, they call it. There's generally a married couple who is the ma and the pa, and then there's, you know, 8 or 10 or fewer kids that are sort of in your family, and each family is given a couple of chickens that they take, and at a certain point they have to kill it and pluck it and cook it and all that stuff, and it's trying to give them the feel for that. There's another area, at least in the one that she went on, where they were trying to mimic how when the men were gone off to the Mormon Battalion, women had to do more of the pulling and stuff, and so there's this huge hill, and the men would all be watching as the women and the young women in the hand carts would have to pull these things up the hill, and they're dying to want to go help them with their big muscles and stuff, but they're all crying at the extremity of you know these women being able to do it and the sense of accomplishment when they do. And I tell you, so in the fast and testimony meeting after this trek, you know, these kids from her ward, these wonderful kids, would all get up there, and how that women's pull was so thing. But it does have this feel of a manufactured spiritual experience, a sort of an attempt to do it in 3 days to capture this experience that probably a heck of a lot more, like you're talking about, Shalice, reading stories and telling real human dramas, at least in addition to it, would certainly be helpful. You know, because you don't want them to have that sense that they really know anything. You know, obviously they're going to know some things more deeply than they would just reading. But overall, you guys are net loss. This isn't something you would encourage your children to be on.
No. We take our children to places that have to do with their ancestors. We talk about it. We encourage them to listen to the stories and read the stories and get to know their ancestors just like they live down the street, or, you know, this is where they lived, and show them. And yes, you can walk in their shoes, but you don't have to necessarily wear the shoes that only go on one foot. the shoes back then, they weren't made right and left. They were just made whatever, and then you had to break them in.
I don't think our kids had to do that. They probably had pretty good walking shoes.
No.
And the hardship for them was no iPods or phones, you know, for 3 days or whatever it is. But, you know, there is something. Here's a question that just occurred to me in the middle of this. Maybe the perspective of what's driving this could be something along the lines of, here we have church leaders, pioneer ancestry, these formative people, and these stories have meant so much to them, and yet they're worrying about our current generation and saying, if we don't do something big, they're going to forget this stuff, because they probably won't feel the way in to the way you, Shalice, say you're to teach your children. They won't see a way that we can, you know, carefully over time share these stories and make these kids love these people and feel connected to them. And so this is what's maybe driving tracks. Does that make any sense as to what might be going on? And does that soften your feelings about it? Either, you know, Johnston speak up, or Gina or Joanna jump in on that.
It does make sense, yeah, that would be why they're doing it, but it's a lousy reason, really and truly. I think that if they would do like what we've all been talking about, stop making them these ultimate heroes and make them real people, that will make kids connect with them. You know, if they know that great-great-grandpa did some stupid things too, they're going to like great-great-grandpa.
But how do they know? How do they know that is going to happen? You know, it's a slow process that you're talking about.
I mean,
or at least they can give them this marker in their life where they, you know, had some experience of these guys.
Well, you know, I mean, it's what you're asking is, how does a culture maintain its mythology across time and keep it vibrant and new? And, you know, we're not the only people on the face of the earth, you know, our oral traditions even. And we're not exactly. the only people on the face of the earth that's faced this question, you know. So if you're not going to make people go, you know, if you're not going to terrorize teenagers and nowhere with dead babies and, you know, I mean, pickle jar stuff. I mean, see, the thing is, I've heard bubblings in different Mormon progressive communities about, you know, what if Mormon feminists, you know, did a trek together. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I've heard ways of people reinventing the trek, but that model clearly has some problems where you put people in a physical vulnerability. I mean, what if we all just had Passover Seders, you know, Pioneer Day dinners, you know, or Pioneer Day service projects or some other
awesome
way of re-ritualizing the holiday, making it, you know, interpreting it forward, you know, remembering the stories, but remembering all of the stories and the potential that holiday has, at least in my experience, the potential it has not to be a source of only lionizing and idealizing alabaster ancestors, but, you know, digging deep into what it is about this faith that brings out a desire in all of us to push forward, you know, to build this Zion. That's a mythology I just want to keep around. And so I beat my kids up with stories of their pioneer ancestors all the time. You know, there's a day to day, you know, telling and living and thinking about it that I'm able to do because I have that ancestry. I wouldn't prescribe it to everybody, right. But there's a way in which we as a culture could, you know, redesign the way we commemorate a little bit to tell it forward.
I absolutely think that we can and we should do that for the church if it wants to expand and continue to grow in countries outside the United States. It's going to have to do that.
Of course.
You know, let the 24th of July be Utah's Founders Day celebration and have it for the rest of the world be a day to remember your ancestors. And I love the Passover
love
Seder
idea.
Kind of idea.
I love it.
And I think we were going to do that this year. I love that.
Green Jell-O.
I'm in the Young Women's Presidency in our branch. And, you know, we've got a lot of converts, we've got a lot of kids who are not that transplant from Utah, that don't have that pioneer ancestry. And we just sat down one day, showed them how to use Ancestry.com, showed them how to use Family Search, and then had a night where I, of course, assigned them homework, where they had to bring in an ancestor and talk about that ancestor and just tell stories. And they were so, we actually had to put it off because of scheduling, got the Meet My Ancestor night, and they were livid. Those girls were so mad because they had these stories that they wanted to tell. And they were just so...
And they weren't just bragging stories?
No.
Did any of them go into the human
Oh, no. Stuff? I mean, there were a couple pioneer stories. There were some really funny stories. There were some, you know, even just my grandma, about my grandma, but you know, they were able to connect with that past because somebody showed them how and gave them a little taste of it.
That is awesome.
Yeah. I thought so.
Gina, how does all this strike you?
Yeah, well, I've just been thinking about our situation here in New Zealand. And I wonder if part of the maturity that our church is coming into, I mean, we're very much a, you know, church and the mission for many years, even my growing up years, but, you know, we're reasonably well established now. And part of that maturity is accepting our own stories.
Right.
And our own place. I mean, yes, celebrate those mythologies. I mean, there's something binding and sweet about mythologies that, you know, it has its place. But there are those stories, but I also think we've kind of reached a point where we need to confront what it means to be a Mormon in our own place. And so here we are in Christ.
Right.
It was
right.
always an Anglican community. You know, they came here to settle it, to establish beautiful churches and elite schools, and we had this kind of passing sort of clergy of young men sort of moving in and out of this city. You know, who are we and, you know, who were we historically with respect to those people? And we've got, you know, people who've grown up in the church and now passing away or in their twilight years. Maybe it's a time to gather their stories and say, what does it mean to you to be in this place and to be a Mormon? And, you know, I think we have to get to a place where we have to celebrate that first, rather than just thinking or imagining that our history is always somewhere else. It's always in Utah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Important.
Very cool. Anybody have anything else that they just really want to say, or should we?
I just wanted to follow up with a comment about that. You know, you hear about the gathering to Zion, and you hear this term Zion thrown around all the time. And one of the biggest lessons I learned on this wagon train was one day we were in Nowhere, Wyoming, and I was with the wagons that day. And there was a gentleman driving a wagon who was pretty cantankerous. You know, he didn't get along with a lot of the other Teamsters, and he was very opinionated and one of those ornery sort of old cowboy types. And as we were going along, his wheel broke. And instantly, guys were jumping down from their wagons. They were grabbing baling wire, duct tape, whatever they had to get this guy's wheel back on so he could make it. He'd been with us from the beginning, and they wanted him to go into Salt Lake with us. And for me, right there, that was when I learned what Zion was. It's people who are one of hearts, and Zion can be anywhere. Zion can even be in my high school classroom if I let it be. It can be anywhere. And it takes all kinds to make Zion, even a cantankerous old man. It takes a gossiper. It takes, you know, somebody who complains. It takes a long-haired hippie. It takes...
It even takes kiwis.
It even takes kiwis. It takes everybody to be part of that Zion. And, you know, if you want to talk about the church and the idea that we're all on this journey to learn something and return to our Heavenly Father, well, we're all on this pioneer journey, just like they were to get to the valley, to get to Salt Lake. And we may take different paths. Sometimes we may stop and say, I ain't going no further, and sit there for a while, and then maybe pick up the trail again or find a different path. But in the end, we're all going to the same place. And wherever you are, create Zion. That's the thing the biggest thing that I got from the wagon train.
And we're not there yet.
Oh, no. Oh, heavens no. And you can't create Zion unless you start with you, and you have to be willing. And not everybody is willing to create that.
It's beautiful. That is awesome. Thank you, Shalice. That is the perfect way to kind of work our way out of this wonderful conversation. Thank you, everyone, for being on. Man, this has gone so much, like, you know, you have high expectations. This is blown the roof off that. So thank you. I've loved every minute of this.
Thank you, Dan.
All right, everybody, come tell your stories. Come share your trek adventures. Do whatever you want on the blog, mormonmatters.org. We'll get this thing up here in the middle of the week before Pioneer Day, and we hope as you listen, you'll want to join the conversation and be a big part of it. And for those of you that come visit the website and feel the urge to donate a few more dollars to keep the podcast going strong and stuff, that would be wonderful too. So, Gina? We love having you on. Thanks for doing this in the middle of your day, the next day from all of us.
Hi, most welcome.
You're awesome. Glad Joanna, we love having you back. We've missed you, and we'll definitely work our way to get you on more often.
Awesome.
If we can pry you away from all the national news media organizations.
This is
you to New York to be on their shows.
La 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 la. This is home for me.
Well, thank you for all that you've brought to this. And Johnston's, wow, were you guys the perfect choice or what to have on this podcast?
I know, right?
Yeah, you guys are just so awesome. Yeah, we love it. No, thank you very much for all you've brought and what you embody and these lessons that you've gained and you've given us a glimpse of, I think, in a way that we could never have gotten if you hadn't had those experiences and are sort of living this life, you know, negotiating all these things all together today. So thank you for sharing.
Our pleasure.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, Dan.
Good night.
All right. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.